Hello and welcome to Theatre Voice. My name is Alex Sears and I'm at the Young Vic today to talk to the award-winning playwright Che Walker, whose latest show, Been So Long, is currently playing here. Walker was born in 1968, the year of student revolutions, and his name refers, of course, to Che Guevara. His debut play was Been So Long, first staged at the Royal Court in 1998, and the current revival is a completely new version with music by Arthur Darvill. As well as working as a director, Che's also written Flesh Wound, as well as The Front Line, which was the first contemporary play to be put on at Shakespeare's Globe. That was last year, and this year it enjoyed another run at the same venue. Welcome to Theatre Voice, Che Walker.
Thank you very much, Alex.
Could you start by talking about how you came to write this new version of Been So Long?
Well, I always really thought that they should sing when I first wrote it. And in fact, the very first time I ever put Been So Long on was in a community centre in Camden. And we had a live jazz band who kind of underscored certain moments of dialogue. And I always thought, oh, this is really interesting, live music. And these characters, more than any, have the width, if you like, and the kind of epic emotional temperature to be able to burst into song. And so it's always kind of nagged me. I mean, I was really proud of the 1998 version at the Royal Court, and it was obviously my debut, and, you know, I love it. But it always nagged me, and I thought I'd really like to come back to these characters as well as an older man now and see if I could... see if I could work it into a musical. Also, what also happened was it briefly went out of print for a while, which is like a kind of bayonet through the heart for any writer. It's like, it doesn't exist anymore, you can't get it. And so I thought, no, I want this to have more life. I want to reintroduce the characters more than anything else. I just felt like I hadn't quite finished with these characters, and I genuinely love these people so much. So it'd been nagging me for a while, and then I was directing a show at RADA about, must be about 3 years ago, maybe even 4 years ago now, and I met Arthur Darvill, who was a brilliant actor as well as a brilliant musician and composer, and he was at RADA, and I heard him playing some stuff, and it was very intriguing, and I approached him, and I was kind of lucky in that, because I was working at the college, I managed to get him before he graduated. Because since he's graduated, he's just going from strength to strength to strength, and he's very much in demand. And I managed to kind of put my claws into him before he'd even left. And we've been kicking it around for, 3 years.
Because you worked with him on The Front Line as well.
He was the composer for The Front Line. He wrote 6 of the songs. Ollie Fox wrote 2 of the songs. And then we took 2 traditional gospel numbers, which had no authors, so we just sort of...
And for this version of Been So Long, you did all the words and he did all the music?
No, we split the lyrics about 50-50. We did try one day to figure out who wrote which lyric and all of that, and we soon found ourselves bogged down. Some of the songs are virtually all Arthur's lyrics, and some of the songs are virtually all my lyrics. Most of them, you'll find, that there's a kind of...
Yeah. Could you describe the plot, the whole sort of situation, briefly?
It's a very slim plot, as critics have the endless fun pointing out to me. The plot revolves around a legendary love god, I guess.
Yeah, which Raymond.
He's a legendary ladies' man. He's brilliant at picking up women. And he meets the one... woman who just won't bend at the start of it and really sees through him, and it forces him to adjust and reevaluate what he's been thinking about.
And that's Simone.
And Simone very much is the same sort of thing. We learn that Simone's had a terrible relationship in the past, which has left her very, very traumatized, I suppose, and scarred by it, and so she's very much unwilling to give herself to love. And yet there's something about Raymond that she can't resist. Despite all his bullshit, she sees not only past his bullshit, but she also sees to this kind of sweetness that is inside him. And then I guess the play is about whether you know it's real and when you know it's real and what's it like for you to take that risk.
And Simone is actually out with her best friend, Yvonne.
Yeah, they're out for a night, a girls' night out.
And they end up in this loser's bar.
Yes, they end up in the Bar Arizona. Or it was originally it was the Bar Phoenix, but we've changed the name because of Peter Kay. And he has his Bar Phoenix in Phoenix Nights.
Right,
and we thought, oh no, that's kind of confusing for us. So, yeah. Even though I wrote my play long before. They're in the Bar Phoenix, the Bar Arizona, which is closing down and which is run by a very sort of lonely guy called Barney, who's the sort of last man standing in this bar. And Barney, I don't want to give too much of the plot away, but he has a secret torch for Simone, which he can never quite express.
And there's also the one other character who, in fact, comes bursting on the scene right at the beginning, called Gil.
Gil is tormented by love,
mm-hmm.
and he was in love with a woman, and Raymond has taken this woman from him, and he's been on a sort of 3-year holy quest to find Raymond and to avenge this dishonor by murdering Raymond. So he's sort of hunting Raymond down. So I guess it's a lot funnier than I'm making it sound, hopefully, anyway.
it is.
Some big laughs in it.
Hopefully. No, it is hilarious.
Thank you. Yeah. I guess the theme is love, really, and the sort of the chaos that love can bring, and the risk that love puts you in, particularly erotic love. Mm. It's interesting looking at it now as a guy, an older guy now. Mm. I was 26 when I wrote the first version. It was actually on at the Royal Court when I was 29, and I just turned 30 while we were running it. And it's a very, it's quite a horny play. I mean, there's a lot about sex.
Yeah.
And it's interesting because now, it's kind of 10 years down the line, I'm like, God, was I ever that? Was I ever that rampant about it? But it, you know, that's what it is. That's what it's about, you know.
The title, early on, Gil has a song.
Yes.
Been so long.
Yes.
And he relates it to the time, more than 3 years, that has passed, or had this run-in with this legendary woman that he sort of immediately fell in love with.
The magical woman. Yeah.
The magical woman.
Yeah.
But also, it's been so long for other characters. I think Raymond's been in prison.
That's right.
It's been...
Yeah. So absolutely, the 3 years is a very significant time span. It absolutely right. It's when Gil fell in love and lost his love. It's around about that time Raymond went into prison, so he's not had any contact really with the opposite sex, any meaningful contact for 3 years. And Simone has also given birth 3 years ago. She has a 3-year-old child, which is sort of because of the horrible way that her child's father has treated both her and the child, that's caused her to sort of shut down, to pull the shutters down. So it's been three years for most of the characters since they've had sex, I guess.
Yeah. And it's kind of slow.
With the exception of Yvonne.
Yeah. In a way, the contrast between them is the child has slowed down Simone a bit.
Yes.
You know, quite naturally.
Yes,
you know,
yeah.
Whereas Yvonne's still quite rampant, unencumbered, isn't it?
She's rampant and unencumbered, and she is very clear about that sex is fun, and that it doesn't have to lead to complications. You can just have it and done. Whereas Simone's view at the top of the play is sex is just a kind of complete thorny maze that you don't want to get lost in, because it just leads to complete heartache and trauma.
In the original, the play had this fantastic, dazzling use of language. You obviously had to do a fair bit of pruning.
Stripping it down.
Yeah, to create this more musical show.
Mm-hmm.
How did you go about that? What did you do?
Well, I think the big thing is to... what we found was that often some of the speeches, mostly the speeches I'm most proud of, were in fact crowding out the songs. And so we found that we were saying things twice.
Yeah.
So someone would say it in a beautiful speech, and then they'd suddenly sing, and you'd be like, well, that's a great song, and it's a great speech, but they're telling me the same thing. I'm just hearing the same message twice. And that's when you have to make some really heartbreaking decisions. And some of my absolute favourite writing, of which I'm most proud of, has had to go. But... I think it was T.S. Eliot who said, "Murder your babies." It was his advice to young writers. You have to serve the story, and nothing else matters other than that.
And what was your work process with Darville? Did you sort of sit around together composing, writing the lyrics?
Yeah.
Or how did that all work out?
Arthur became very busy when he left college, and the first song he sent to me on an MP3, he did it on his own. The first song he ever wrote for the show was "Been Too Long," which is Gil's song, and he sent me that, and I just thought, this is fantastic. And then most of the process was actually the two of us in a room, and we talk about what we thought the moment was, and I think what sets Arthur apart is that he, because of his training as an actor, he's very attuned to drama, and he's very attuned to the characters as well. So he would have a particular sound for a particular character. And I mean, if you think, for instance, of Raymond's musical journey through the piece, he's got three songs on his own and a duet, and the first song is incredibly simple and incredibly solid. The beat is very, very solid. It's a reggae tune. And the melody is very, very easy to get hold of and sing. And then Fire begins to get more tricky and more complicated as he realizes, he has the lyric, "What's this feeling that I'm feeling? I'm feeling like I'm born again." And then he has the duet with Simone. And then his last song is a really tricky, it's very hard to sing, that last one. And it's very raw and open. And that's an example of how clever Arthur is and how talented he is that he's graded the dramatic journey in music.
And you've had very good reviews for this, by and large.
By and large, yes.
Yeah. But occasionally reviewers mentioned that they thought that the songs slowed down the action a bit.
Yeah.
Is that something that you feel now, or do you contest that?
No, I think they can eat shit and die, personally. I do want to continue. I haven't seen it for a couple of days, and I came in today, and I'm very, very proud of my cast. I think they're extraordinary, but I do want to shave a little bit of dialogue out of it still. I think what they're responding to is that I as first time musical writers, and also my first time directing a musical, it's the launch into the songs. I would like to just fine tune in just a couple of places how that happens. I think a lot of it really flows really smoothly, but there's a section that I want to have a little look at.
Fair enough. In one of the songs, I think it's Yvonne, there's the Kite Hill sex fantasy,
yeah,
which she does as a kind of voiceover.
Yeah.
And obviously that's one of the things I remember from the original production. And can you talk a bit about that? Because it's this really wild sexual fantasy, open-air sex,
yeah,
and with lots of references to wood.
Yes, 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 yes.
As wild, yeah, kind of satyr-like sex. Where did that all come from?
Well, it's really weird. I have no memory of writing it at all. The only thing I remember is that it was a sort of quite a sweaty afternoon. It was quite a hot afternoon. But I can't remember writing it. I guess what I was dealing with was that I used to... The bar that it's set in was a real bar. It's now gone. But I used to go there a lot. And there were a lot of young women who were on the hunt. And it always struck me, I was always looking at them and thinking, it would be very easy to dismiss these women as just tarts and sluts or what have you, but I was always struck by how brave they were, because they were very confident to go up to men, which I thought was interesting. And it occurred to me that this was a very deep and deeply felt need that they had, which was about an inner life. And in a fantasy life. So that was the kind of springboard for it. I didn't want anyone judging Yvonne or making a comment on her. I wanted to show that she has real depth, and she has an incredibly fertile and powerful fantasy life. And she makes one reference to her job, which has been updated. In the original, she says, I had these fantasies while I'm sitting at this typewriter, and now it's been updated, so she's sitting at an Apple Mac. So I imagine that her job is perhaps not the most interesting job in the world, it's not that exciting for her to do, and yet inside her it's this extraordinary dream life.
And it's an empowering fantasy as well. She's yeah. in control. I think
yes.
that's quite important.
Yes, yeah. And I get a lot of satisfaction from seeing women in the audience because they really like that speech, and it's great. It's great to see how they react.
When I interviewed you for the In Your Face book, I remember you saying that the play had been rejected originally by some theatres.
Oh, yeah.
Because they thought the language was unrealistic.
Mm.
And how do you sort of respond to that?
Well, much like I respond to critics, I can eat shit and die as far as I'm concerned. But my response is, you know, if you're reading or you're going to see something from the Elizabethan era, I can't imagine you sit there and go, well, like, this is ringing completely false because they're speaking in iambic pentameter, or they're suddenly speaking in rhyming couplets. Well, this has completely broken my belief in this world. I think that theatre, if it's about anything, it's about language. Going back to that Elizabethan period, people would talk about going to hear a play. They wouldn't necessarily go that we're going to see a play tonight. They'd say we're going to hear a play. So it's about words, it's about rhythm, and it's about language. And but that's what excites me and intoxicates me, is that. And it's a curious thing because I never ever questioned it that they would have this kind of eloquence. And the people who always raise it are always, well, I'm puzzled because clearly these working class characters and yet they know words like indefatigable. I remember one guy saying to me, well, where would she possibly have learnt this word? And I was like, well, where did you learn it? You know, you read it somewhere and you looked
or
it
you
up
heard it.
You heard someone say it, yeah. You know, and you liked it and you used it.
Yeah. And actually you might use it even without knowing what it means.
Sometimes you do, sometimes you use it incorrectly, or sometimes you make your own
word
out of it.
And in fact, your characters are constantly making up words as well.
Absolutely.
Or playing with them.
Yeah.
Bing dong, bing bang, all that kind of thing.
Yeah, and I was so surprised when people picked up on it, because I was like, it's a play, you can say what you like.
If you actually talk to people in bars and on the street, quite often their way of expressing themselves is quite baroque and ornate.
This is certainly my experience, Alex. I think that people are far more creative and original and lyrical in their use of language than we give them credit for. And I think a lot of that is overlooked at school, perhaps because there's such emphasis on the written side of it, and we don't actually listen to how original people are and how they express themselves. And getting back, I mean, I do have to say, I don't want to turn into some sort of militant, but I do detect a slight whiff of class arrogance around this area and about the language that's used in this play.
In other words, the middle class view is that working class people should just speak earthy and basic.
And sort of, well, that's how I understand them to speak, and suddenly, well, they're using these words, and I don't know.
Well, certainly, I mean, your language is heightened. Obviously, one of my favourites, and I'm sure I'm not alone, is decimate your arse.
Thank you.
I think that's a brilliant line. And there's lots of things like fashioned from gold and chiselled by thunder.
Yeah.
Unfreeze your heart is another nice one. And dancing the dance that the dolphins dance. That's so sweet.
I like it.
The play's also about damage.
Yeah.
You're dealing with characters who are damaged, and there is this thing about the way damage attracts damage, sort of psychologically.
Yeah.
Is that something that has struck you as well?
I think so, yeah. I mean, I think that's why Raymond and Simone, there's a sort of almost instinctive recognition of each other, that they've been through something, and that they're at once much stronger for having gone through it, and yet they're also damaged, this experience is holding them back in some way. And I think when we spoke years ago about the play, I think I said then that my original version had a really happy end between the two of them, and it just didn't sit right because they are such traumatized people. And if you're going to respect that and honor that, you want to leave it slightly suspended. And one of the, I think it's slightly different in the musical version, but in the original version, when he was so much more brutal with her at the end, it was fascinating because the two actors used to sometimes say, oh man, I really don't think we had any chance tonight of making it. And other nights they'd play it and they'd come off and go, oh no, I think Raymond and Simone had a chance. And it'd be the same with the audience. People come up and say, those two people shouldn't even live in the same country, let alone be together. And other nights they go, no, I think they can work it through. You know.
I remember that one of the original reviews talked about that phrase, my girl Simone, love a damaged man.
And yes.
We all do, that's how you lot get away with it, which is Yvonne's statement. And I remember you pointed out, in fact, that Barney comes back and says...
My ex-wife never let me get away with fuck all. Don't include me in that. Yeah.
Yeah.
I remember...
So actually, it's much more... You're not actually... That isn't the message of the play,
no.
Is it?
No. I'm not really into giving messages... as such, and I do remember that review because I remember being very irked by it because the critic laid that line out and sort of said, this is his message, and I was like, it really isn't. And if you'd listen to the next line, you'd see that I'm trying to just keep it all open.
Yeah, and balanced.
Yeah.
Okay, let's move on to The Front Line.
Sure.
That's also set in Camden.
Yeah.
Not Somerstown, but just outside Camden Station.
Just outside the station, yeah.
So was that a commission that you got from the Globe?
Yeah.
Shakespeare's Globe?
Yeah, it was very, very amazing experience to do. And it all. I met Dominic Drumgoole at a wedding. And he had rejected Been So Long when he was at the Bush. And sent me a letter, which I still have somewhere, which I'm going to remind him of one day. met him at this wedding, and he called me in and took me on the space, and I just couldn't believe the theatre. I'd never, to my shame, I'd never been to the Globe before, and he walked me onto the stage, and it's such an extraordinary, powerful space. And I thought he was going to ask me to write a historical play, which is what they'd all been up until then. And I was thinking, oh, I don't know, it's not really where I'm at. And I'm not really bright enough to write those sort of things, you know. And to my astonishment, he just said, let's have a go at doing something contemporary. And I said, but you can't do that, Dominic. This is the Globe. And he came back with a few choice words about what he can and can't do. And was very kind of gung-ho and said, let's do this. And The Front Line came out of that.
It's a kind of panorama play, isn't it?
Yes.
I don't know, how many characters have you got there?
It's 23 characters.
Yeah.
And then there's 6 street fighters and a band. Yeah. It's a big number. It's not cheap.
And clearly with something like that, you have to sort of cast your net wide.
Yes.
So can you just give us some indication, if you've got the inclination, about who's in the play?
The characters.
Yeah.
Well, I mean,
there's Beth the Christian.
Yeah.
There's...
Well, it goes from 16 up to about 75. So the youngest guy in the show is Elliot, who is a sort of lost boy who's getting sucked into the drug economy and starting to do big work for big people, and he's not really ready to do it. And at the other end of the spectrum is Ragdale, who is a sort of upper middle class man in his 70s, had some sort of military background. We never quite pinned down what his military experience was. And he is on a quest to find his lost daughter.
And in fact, every woman he meets of a certain age, thinks...
Absolutely, every single woman in the play, he comes up to and goes, oh my God, I found my daughter, this is wonderful, whether they're black, white, however old they are, he's just like, this is my daughter, I found her. And then there's lots of people in between. Yes, you mentioned Beth. I guess one of the big themes of The Front Line is the drug economy, which fuels that particular little corner there, and particularly after dark. And wanted to write about that for a long time. And I guess immigration in some sort of way. The fact that London's changed. I mean, Dominic was very keen for me to write something about London now.
Yeah.
And one of the great strengths of London is its ability to fuse and its ability to mutate all the time. And it happens so quickly.
Yeah.
And so I really wanted to capture that and say something about
it. Yeah, you've got a hot dog seller.
Yeah.
Erkenwald.
Erkenwald, which is the name of the patron saint of London.
Oh, I didn't know.
Erkenwald. Yeah, okay. Yeah.
Yeah, because there is some history, actually.
Yeah.
You know, there are little sort of quiet historical asides, I remember.
Yeah, there are. Yeah, yeah.
And there's a lot of comedy as well. My favourite, I'm sure I'm not alone, is Mordecai Thurrock, the actor. Yes. You know, constantly phoning.
Poor Mordecai.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway, and the songs, once again, was that the start of the project, the idea of having songs?
I definitely wanted big songs, and I would argue, some people say that The Frontline is a musical, and I would argue that it's not a musical. I would say it's a play with a lot of songs, and I'll try and identify what I think it's different, is that all the songs kind of step out of the action. They're in a way like a kind of chorus. So we have the play, and then we stop for a minute and we have a song just to say, wow, isn't this sad, and do we have to live like this? I don't think we do. And then bang, we're back into the play. Where it's been so long, the action is, despite what some critics say, the action is advanced through the song. So I'm presenting a case to you, I'm trying to seduce you while I'm singing.
The songs are interesting in The front line and I did have trouble with some of the lyrics.
Right.
We're the invisible ones.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
But they're not, are they? Because not only do we see these people every day.
Yeah.
But they're also on British stages all the time. You know, low life, underclass, you know, working class, whatever you want to call them.
Yeah.
You know, we are constantly familiar with them. So it's not really true. Or do you think it is?
Well, maybe we're familiar with them in theatre.
Mm.
What I see a lot in Camden is, and I'm certainly guilty of it myself, is just sort of quietly stepping over people who really could probably do with a little bit of attention, you know, medical or otherwise.
Yeah, yeah.
So I think that's what I'm referring to, really, is this tendency to avoid people. And the front line is full of people who you perhaps rightly you would want to cross the road if you saw them coming. And perhaps that's the wisest thing to do with them. But I think they are invisible. They are stepped over. They only come out at night, a lot of these people. Particularly the addicts and that whole horrible kind of carousel that you can see around there. Just desperate.
Another lyric, the war on drugs is just a war on blacks.
Does it say just a war on blacks?
I think so, yeah.
War on drugs, just a war on blacks. Yeah. I'm not sure.
That's not true, is it?
It's a war on the poor. But it doesn't rhyme quite as well, and it doesn't lead me to my next rhyme about Iraq. The war on drugs is definitely a war on the poor. That I will absolutely stand by. And Alex, you are—I mean, like the young guy who did that ramp—he is 7 times more likely to be stopped and searched by the police than you are. And even I am. So in that sense, I think you can argue it. He's also 3 times more likely to be given a custodial sentence for a first offence. Do you know what I mean? The statistics will back it up. I actually did cut that the second time around because it slowed down the action a little bit. Yeah.
Did you do a lot of changes with it? Did you tighten it up?
Yeah, I cut about 10 minutes.
Now, there's a problem with doing new writing in the open air.
Yeah.
And that's partly the overlapping dialogue.
Yes.
Because when you read your play, obviously you can understand everything that's happening. My problem at Shakespeare's Globe was that actually it was quite difficult to follow quite often.
Yeah.
Because it's an open space.
Yeah.
And any kind of subtlety with writing and something you use it to the wind.
Did
you have that experience yourself, or?
It's hard for me because by the time it's up there, I know every single line of it off by heart, so I can hear it. But as a first time listener, I can see there'd be a problem. It was designed. You're not meant to hear everything. That whole initial chaotic moment was designed that you don't hear everything, and that you I wanted to keep you everyone off balance, and I think Matthew did a brilliant job with the way he staged that beginning.
That's Matthew Dunster, Matthew the director. Dunster,
yeah. Fabulous director. So you're sort of going, oh my God, is this important? This is great. And then you're pulled over here, and in a way, what did begin to happen was people kind of chose what they wanted to watch.
Oh yeah, which strand to follow.
Yeah, and they're like, well, I'm interested in this gay couple, so I'm going to follow them, and I'm not so interested in the Christian and that. And what was very good for us was that people came back because they were like, I missed that whole other strand, so I'm like, I'm going to watch this time. Yeah. And depending on where you stood or sat, you would get a completely different show. Yeah, I mean, it was a big risk there, and we didn't know if it was going to work or not. And it's interesting because when we did the readings in a closed room, you get a much better sense, and you can actually hear everything, even when they're all talking at once. You kind of go, oh, I can hear this, I can hear this. I accept what you're saying, open air. I mean, you should have been there when it rained. It was just absolute madness. It was madness. It was a nightmare.
And are you working on another play with music?
I'm about I'd say about 30 pages in to another play with I guess.
And don't tell me it's set in Summer's Town.
No, it's not actually. No. I'm trying to the front line actually doesn't mention Camden. It actually mentions Camden a few times, but I took it out. If you read the beginning, it just says a busy tube station. I'm trying to move away from that just because it helps. One of these guys called me the laureate of Camden Town or something, which is certainly not what I want to do. It's helpful for me, and it was as a young writer, to go, right, it's in that bar and it's in that street, or it's
or
in
flesh wound in that flesh block of
it's
flats,
exactly that block of flats, which is the flats I grew up across the road from. But it's not what I'm writing about. I mean, you know. So I'm stripping that out now, even though I'll know where we're supposed to be.
Well, you're moving on.
Moving on.
Great, that's a nice place to end it. Thanks for watching.